This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is The Jewish Problem and Antisemitism, Part 2. This is the 53rd installment of Age of Treason Radio, and to mark the occasion, I've changed the music at the very end, made it 30 seconds shorter, so I have a little bit more time to talk. The program page has a link to the music. It's Sigur Rós, Homeland. I wanted to continue what I was talking about the last time and to reiterate some of the points that I made then and to extend them, and especially to talk a little bit more about Wilhelm Marr and his essay. But I want to start by mentioning that quote from Count Cherub-Spiradovich, however you pronounce his name, that I read last time that I was so impressed by. There's two things about that. First of all, I couldn't actually find that in the online version of the Hidden Handbook that it was Metapedia cited it coming from. When I searched the internet, there wasn't any hit for it that didn't refer to the Hidden Hand. So I don't know, maybe I'm just not getting the right version of the Hidden Hand. But it's possible that he never said this, which it doesn't really matter to me, because I think that the expression, what he had to say was spot on and I missed making the point as to how exactly. Let me read it one more time. Are we going to let our world be destroyed so as not to offend a tiny number of people who accuse us of antisemitism? And this is the part that I didn't emphasize, and I want to emphasize this time. Accuse us of antisemitism to cover up the crimes they are committing against us. That's the psychological mechanism. The tactic that they're using is to put us on the defensive. They attack. This is a Jewish tactic, is rather than feel that they need to defend themselves, when that kind of feeling comes over them, instinctually, it seems, they attack. And they attack even more viciously, maybe, than they were attacking before. So that you're too busy thinking about defending yourself and especially on the terms that they do. As I said, that this Jewish problem and antisemitism are related. They're two sides of the same coin. And if you're too busy feeling sorry for the Jews about antisemitism, well, then you're not feeling sorry for yourself and your own people and the Jewish problem that the Jews create for your people. So that's how that works, and that's partly why I thought that Cherub-Spiradovich statement was why I was so impressed with it. Now, to continue with Wilhelm Marr, I mentioned the last time, just briefly, that I was disappointed after the build-up and the way he's described, the way he's perceived today, to the extent he's perceived at all, that he's known by anybody. That I was disappointed when I finally read his essay on the Jews. And I want to go into why I'm disappointed and explain it. I mentioned quickly the last time that it was because he comes across as pro-Jew and anti-German and defeatist. And that is what the problem is in a nutshell. But let me give some specific examples. At first, I want to mention that in the foreword, the translator of this piece mentions that Marr is sometimes credited with actually coining the term anti-Semitism, and the translator points out that the term doesn't occur in this paper and that there is some controversy over whether Marr coined it. And I mentioned the last time that the Metapedia article on anti-Semitism credits some Jew several decades earlier and with coining the term. But it's pretty well agreed that Marr popularized the term. And in a good sense, he in a way, he was coming up with a new term for the Jewish problem. And he called it anti-Semitism to describe himself, and he created the League of Anti-Semites, an organization to struggle against Jewish rule. So Marr himself, in his own preface, describes what he's trying to do in this essay of his, this pamphlet. "I shall announce loudly and without any attempt to be ironic that Judaism has triumphed on a worldwide historical basis. I shall bring the news of a lost battle and of the victory of the enemy, and all of that I shall do without offering excuses for the defeated army." And it's true. He doesn't offer any excuses for the Germans. He's actually quite caustic and acidic in his criticism of the Germans. He sounds like a Jew, in fact, in the way he criticizes the Germans. And on the flip side of that, he excuses the Jews in several ways. Basically, he accepts the Jewish version of history and regurgitates in all the important points the Jewish narrative, what I refer to as the Jewish narrative, which is this idea that the Jews have just been kicked around and victimized and oppressed for their whole history by Europeans who, and of course the Jews did nothing wrong and it was all the Europeans' fault. And Marr agrees essentially on that, mouths that himself. Now, the thing about Marr, though, is that he also saw some things that are good. I mean, he makes some good points about the Jews. For one thing, he saw the long-term nature of the Jewish problem, and he saw it as a conflict of interests, a mutual hostility between distinct peoples. He actually referred to it as a battle for survival between these distinct people. So he had a Darwinian worldview. He didn't refer to it as such, but, and you know, this was, you know, he wasn't the only one, but this is, was the shift before Marr to after Marr was from viewing Jews as this, these peoples, these strange, mysterious peoples with a strange religion, to a racial understanding, a biological understanding of them as a people, genetically related to each other, or at least related by heredity to each other, racially related. And Marr makes that point, that that's the main point of his paper, where the subtitle is Viewed from a Non-Religious Point of View. He views the Jews from a non-religious point of view, which was uncommon. I don't want to say he's the first one who did it, but he was the most notable one who did it and started a trend then of seeing the Jews non-religiously. Let me give an example here of him being pro-Jewish. He goes into why he doesn't think it's about religion, and then he states, "I therefore unconditionally defend Jewry against any and all religious persecution and think that there is hardly possible to express this more clearly than I have done here. On the other hand, I emphasize the following indisputable truth: with the Jews, the Romans have forced a tribe upon the West, which, as its history shows, was thoroughly hated by all the peoples of the Orient." A couple of things mixed in together there in those two paragraphs. First of all, he's doing the same thing that has come up in The International Jew and Henry Ford and his writers, expressing their disbelief or their surprise that the Jews complain about religious persecution because they don't see it. They think that Americans just haven't religiously persecuted anyone. It seems Europeans have this tolerance, this inbuilt desire to be tolerant, especially of other religions. And I think that's partly imposed. It's before Marr's time, the Jews spent a lot of their effort trying to instill that in Europeans that, oh, you should feel sorry for us because after all, you know, we wrote your Bible. You know, basically, that's the line, the gist of it. And that's why religious tolerance is emphasized or always has been. It's I don't mean to make it sound like it. I think it's some sort of inbuilt genetic flaw in Europeans. Altruism, possibly, but, you know, specifically toward religion, no. I don't think we stand up for ourselves well enough. That's true enough. But I think it has to do with mindset and propaganda, and Jews trying to make us not stand up for ourselves is a big part of it. Anyway, another point here is that Marr blames the Romans. He excuses the Jews. It wasn't the Jews that brought themselves to Europe. It was the Romans' fault for bringing them to Europe. And that's nonsense. The Jews go where the Jews want to go. And if you don't let them in, they start whining. Why won't you let us in your country, you horrible racist? That's one thing that the history of the Jews shows clearly. They go where they want to, all over the world, using a variety of mechanisms, but that's the basic one, is claiming that you need to be tolerant. And if you don't let them in and don't let them do what they want and don't give them superior protection and rights, ultimately, that you're an anti-Semite, that you're anti-Jewish, you're just a hater and intolerant. And they work on people's psychology that way. And certainly on Europeans, that has been the general mechanism. But Marr does at least recognize the Jewish problem when he states that Jews have been hated by all the peoples of the Orient. And he means now in the Jewish history, before they even moved into Europe, it was established that the Jews had been hated by all the peoples that they had tried to live amongst. So he saw that Jewish problem and wrote about it openly. But he actually uses the words oppression and persecution to describe their history. He calls them victims. And there he goes, excusing the Jews again for feeling this hatred toward Europeans. He explains it as being sort of their reaction to being persecuted and oppressed. And I've made the point before, but I'll make it again. If they felt so oppressed and persecuted in Europe, the wandering Jews should have just wandered off somewhere else. Now, he does make some good points, too. He makes this amazing prediction that ended up coming true, that Jewry would eventually precipitate a revolution in Russia. And he writes, "With Russia, Jewry will have captured the last strategic position from which it has to fear a possible attack on its rear. But once it has paralyzed Russia, its rear will be perfectly secure. After it has invaded Russia, Russia's offices and agencies the same way it did ours," meaning the Germans, "then the collapse of our Western society will begin in earnest, openly, and in Jewish fashion. The last hour of doomed Europa will strike at the latest in 100 to 150 years, since events develop more rapidly now than they did in past centuries." Well, it's been 135 years or so since he first published this prediction. And there was indeed the Russian Revolution, and it was a bloodbath, a Jewish bloodbath. He refers to the struggle between Europeans and Jews as an 800-year-long war, and he says it's nearing its end. Then he writes, and this part really bothers me, "We have been vanquished in open battle. Yes, in open battle, because Jewry has always shown its true face and their little falsehood that we acted like religious fanatics when we offered resistance must be forgiven." No, I don't forgive it, and he's exactly wrong there. It wasn't an open battle. First of all, the most important point to make about this is that, as I said, it was understood as a religious issue up until Marr's time. Then he says, "Oops, we lost," and they did it out in the open. They didn't do it out in the open. It was a racial struggle all along under the guise of it being religion. And the whole time, of course, Europeans were guilt-tripped about not being religiously tolerant enough. And to this day, of course, we hear from the Jews their sob stories about not being tolerated for the 2,000 years that they've forced themselves amongst Europeans, to live amongst Europeans. The Jewish identity and their tales about their history are full of lies. To a first approximation, it's a lie. The whole thing is a lie. So for Marr to claim that it was all out in the open, an open battle, is ridiculous. It's certainly not open in the sense that any Nordic, Aryan, European would consider open battle being done, where people are honest about who they are and who their enemy is. The whole time, the Jews knew that there was a war, and they knew that what they were doing, and they were conscious, hyper-conscious, of their own identity as a people, whereas the Europeans weren't. Now, he dates the overthrow of German society by Jews to 1848. He says that the financial control over German society actually went back farther than that, but that they came to social equality and social dominance, political dominance, when they got fully emancipated in 1848 for the last time. They had been emancipated earlier under Napoleon, but those had been rescinded when Napoleon was ultimately defeated. But in 1848, so several decades before, 30 years earlier, before he was writing, that he thought for the past 30 years the Jews had actually been in control of Germany. So let me move on here and talk now about a movie, a film, that I watched a few weeks ago called Gentleman's Agreement. And this was a black and white film made in 1947, right after the war. And it won the Oscar for the Best Picture in 1948. Starred Gregory Peck was the big star in it. IMDb's synopsis of it is, a reporter pretends to be Jewish in order to cover a story on antisemitism and personally discovers the true depths of bigotry and hatred, which I think is interesting because we could use a film today about Jews pretending to be white in order to disguise the true depths of their bigotry and hatred against whites. And it would help whites to understand and discover this ongoing stealthy Jewish war. You know, here we are 135 years after Marr was talking about open war. It still isn't an open war. It's still being done by stealth. The Jews still pretend that they're just like everybody else, and that except that they're an oppressed people. They're powerless victims, and always have been. Now, this film had a big impact on people's attitudes, and what it portrays visually is very appealing. It's a white-dominated society. It's a glimpse of high society in New York post-war. Every face is white, and there's only a sprinkling of Jews to play little bit parts. And the movie was about guilt-tripping them for being bigots. And they make some references to politicians at the time, probably the last politicians that were openly pro-white. They mention Gerald L.K. Smith, Theodore Bilbo, and Congressman John Rankin. The premise of the movie is that this all-white society, this affluent, civil, pleasant, cultured society that's portrayed, is actually sick. That there is this deep bigotry and hatred behind the scenes, under the surface, and that this is a problem. a problem from whose point of view? Of course, it's a problem from the Jews' point of view, but the movie tries to portray it as our problem. It's a problem for all of us because it's unfair. This discrimination, this inequality, this exclusion. And the title, Gentleman's Agreement, refers to one of the bits of exclusion that comes up in the movie, which is the agreement, the gentleman's agreement that people had in that day about who to sell to or not to sell to when it came to their neighborhoods and how to keep their neighborhoods white. And this is freedom of association. And this is portrayed in the movie, of course, as this horrible injustice. It's a major plot point. Of course, now, in retrospect, we can see how silly this whole notion that this wonderful society that they had was flawed in this way, because we see now the consequence of what the real problem was, which is that the whites were able to be guilt-tripped and, as a consequence, opened their society and became more inclusive and allowed these Jews not only to live amongst them, but ultimately to come to full power in the United States. And what we have today, of course, is rampant anti-white, a rampant anti-white society, and getting worse every day for whites. And so the real problem was that whites fell for this fraud, and that's what it was. Especially in retrospect, we can say for sure that that's what it was. It was the promise of some sort of utopian future where there was no prejudice or discrimination or bigotry or hatred. And as we see, bigotry and hatred haven't disappeared. It's just that whites are no longer in control, and so whites are the ones now who are subjected to the bigotry and the hatred most of all. It was wishful thinking. That was the real problem that whites had. The film is about fighting anti-Semitism, really. It's already the point of view has shifted from whites having a problem with Jews to the Jews being victims and the problem being anti-Semitism against them. So from their point of view. And some of the things that come up in the film are how Jews change their names. Of course, they portray it the way Jews like to describe it, as them being forced to do so by the horrible anti-Semites. And what it really is them lying about who they are. Instead of wearing their Jewishness on their sleeve and admitting their identity, their otherness, which they feel very deeply, they hide it, they disguise it. And then, of course, they blame the other for making them do it. The crime that the Jews are hiding here by turning it around and calling this anti-Semitism, keeping them out of country clubs or hotels, anti-Semitism, Jew hate, is that they've turned white society upside down and inside out. The mistake that whites made was not excluding the Jews entirely from the country as a whole. Once Jews got their foot in the door, they ultimately rose to power and took over. And now it's the whites being reduced to an oppressed, victimized minority in the United States and in every other white country in the world. Now, the last item I'd like to talk about just briefly here is an ordinary run-of-the-mill rabbi out in Wyoming, in Rabbi Harley Kartz Wagman. And he's written quite a few little pieces concerning Jewishness and his views on it.
And one in particular, he titled Antisemitism and Jewish Power, and he echoed some of the same points that I've already mentioned. And I just want to touch on those. He mentions, he writes, "We have good reasons to fear antisemitism, but at times we make it the core of our identity." He's agreeing with what Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks had to say about Jews considering themselves victims and that being really the core of their identity. And here, this rabbi expresses it slightly differently, as antisemitism being the core of their identity. And this is a good point, that as parasites, they really do require a host. The host is what gives them their identity. They're not the host, and the host is the enemy. Whereas the host doesn't need the parasite. Whites don't need Jews. That's the truth at the center of the Jewish tales of antisemitism, is if there were no Jews around, there wouldn't be any antisemitism. There wouldn't be any Jewish problem. That rabbi continues, "Some say that Jews obsess about antisemitism." He writes a little later in his paper, "We now have sufficient power," he's talking about the good news about antisemitism, "we now have sufficient power to combat antisemitism, at least in America." Well, this is a misrepresentation of what's really going on, as we see in this, just from this one example of this film, Gentleman's Agreement, that supposedly before the Jews had power, they were combating antisemitism. They've been combating antisemitism their whole existence, because it's just the flip side of the Jewish problem. The Jews aren't a problem if they don't have power. It's having power that enables them to create the very problem that they then cause, that they then call antisemitism, when people react to that problem that they create. Over the past few centuries, there's been a shift from Europeans, whites, being in control of their own societies to Jews being in control of those societies. And that's why the terms have shifted from Jewish problem, which is how Europeans and whites used to describe it, as a Jews being a problem for themselves, for whites, to what it's called today, which is antisemitism, global antisemitism, with Jews wringing their hands and having big meetings to discuss how they're going to further reduce our freedom to discuss what's going on, to discuss our own identity and what's good for us. That's categorized as hate, intolerance, bigotry, and they want to suppress it legally. And this, of course, this is part of the Jewish problem, creating problems for us. Jewish power is based on fraud. It's based on lies, big lies. And once those lies are exposed, whether to an individual or a group of people, and when it reaches a tipping point, either within that individual or within the group, that sympathy and goodwill that's created by that fraud, fraudulently, can turn very quickly into the opposite, into enmity and ill will. The Jews have a saying that a philo-Semite is just an anti-Semite who doesn't know it yet. And that's what they mean by that. They realize very well that any awareness of Jews can very quickly turn. The way I would put it is, a white man who's afraid of being called an anti-Semite just doesn't understand the Jewish problem yet.